It is the welcome back. It is the welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are back today to do some work on teaching people some better persuasion techniques. It's gotten complicated out there. We sort of need better tools, I keep finding. And so that's what the purpose of the podcast is to give you some better tools. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor. They left a door open in the ivory tower and I leaped. Also a late night comedy writer, longtime stand-up, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. And I write quite a bit about persuasion in books and over at Substack, various newsletters like Persuasion for Parents. Go check that out if you want to find out wonderful ways to get your children to say yes. Whether they really know why or not, doesn't particularly matter. Here on the podcast, I talk about a few things. I talk to comedians about their politics, always interesting. I convert conservatives and people from perspectives that I worry about a little bit. And I talk to persuasion professionals who are out there fighting their way through the persuasion jungles and figuring it out. And I talk to rhetoricians and academics. My guest today, I would put in as persuasion pro. We met on Lunch Club as probably, I don't know, I've probably done 20 or 25 of these now from Lunch Club people. Just very interesting meeting random people in the world on that platform. She works in the human gut. She's a gut person from the gut. And she's a chief of staff at Tiny Health. Very interesting background. And we're going to talk a lot today about, you know, what it means to actually work within what I would consider to be a fairly advanced, cutting edge type of medicine and health area when most people haven't even caught up to the old stuff. How are you going to drag them up to now? So please welcome Nita Jain.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I don't know what it says when I say, please welcome. There's nobody here other than you and I.
Yeah.
Everybody hypothetically welcome Nita Jain.
Hypothetically. I like that.
So you're in Atlanta, right?
Yes, sir. I am. Eastern time zone.
Is that where your company's located or is that just... like, are you guys all local or are you one of these virtual now split across the universe companies that everybody seems to be working in?
Yeah, we are remote first. We're a Delaware C corporation, but we have employees all over the world, Portugal, Netherlands, Chile, and in the United States, we're split across multiple time zones as well. So yeah, we're definitely one of those remote first global companies, but although we're a small team, we're spread across several geographic areas.
So you've had a really, I looked at your bio and you have a really interesting sort of, it looks like you've always worked in health, but you've come at it from a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different, you know, job titles and angles. Let's just take us back through your sort of entry and progression through this, because you've ended up in a really interesting place, but take us through some of the pathway of getting there.
Sure. So my interest in the gut microbiome, which is where I work right now, stemmed from personal health issues. And for me, they started in the aftermath of receiving fluoroquinolone antibiotics during my last semester at university. I was a biochemistry major, so science was always my passion. And I just kind of got led into microbiology based off of health troubles that I had in the aftermath of receiving these antibiotics. And for those who might be unaware, the fluoroquinolone antibiotics, they are known for having like a wide range of like really devastating side effects in some cases. They come with several black box warnings for things like tendinitis, aortic aneurysm. They also have a high risk of neuropathy and neurological effects, as well as psychological side effects such as suicidal ideation. So they're a pretty like a nasty group, and they should be used as a last resort.
And they told you all of that before they gave it to you, right?
Absolutely not. Yeah, I was not aware of any of this beforehand. And they're actually very frequently prescribed for, you know, minor infections such as UTIs that are uncomplicated, bronchitis, things where, a safer antibiotic would probably do the job, but they're often used as the first line rather than the last resort for which they're intended. So I think that's one of the issues. It's just that they're not being used very judiciously. And I was unfortunately one of the few people who did have systemic side effects in the aftermath. I experienced, you know, seizures, neuropathy, lots of GI issues. I developed several autoimmune conditions after these antibiotics. It was crippling enough to forced me to drop out of university. And I, you know, my health journey was kind of convoluted. Traditional medicine didn't have a whole lot of answers for us. All they could tell me is that I had some sort of inflammation, some sort of unspecified autoimmune disease. We saw all kinds of different practitioners, functional medicine, naturopaths, holistic, you know, we tried Ayurvedic medicine, TCM, all kinds of things and treatments and modalities. I tried to be as evidence-based as possible with it, but, you know, I was also willing to kind of like step outside of the box because like, you know, traditional Western medicine wasn't serving our purpose very well. And I, in my experience, at least, things that made the biggest difference for me were like, you know, dietary modifications, targeting my gut microbiome, especially in the way of fecal transplant, which I might, you know, delve into more later if you feel like it. And also like paying attention to like, you know, my circadian rhythms, optimizing those as much as possible. But yeah, for me, like the biggest thing that really kind of put me on the path back towards health was, you know, things that targeted my gut microbiome, specifically fecal transplant. So that's how I kind of got into it. And yeah, I'm now working at Tiny Health and we focus on...
Let me stop you just a second because I came into alternative health through the paleo community. So my progression was I had never been able to control my weight. And at some point was like, I'm living in Austin. I was dating a vegan. And I was always like, that sounds so weird that you could go a day without eating meat. Like, is that even possible? You know, because it was so far afield from the way I'd been raised in the cultural training I'd had for food. And then I realized I knew nothing about food. I knew nothing about the body chemistry. I knew nothing about any of this. And so I switched over and started eating vegan. And it wasn't that it was bad. It just never felt right culturally to me. And I'm like, this doesn't feel like me. And then I was listening to podcasts about it and saw paleo and listened to Rob Wolf's podcast. And I'm like, oh, these guys sound like me. They sound much more like who I am and the way I live. And so I jumped over to paleo. And when you're in paleo, you get all the whole spectrum of everything you just talked about. Everything from the craziest, wildest, newest approaches to the most esoteric, spiritually based. You know, I've got paleo friends who are now far down the pathway of ayahuasca. And I'm like, okay, I see you over there. Hey. But they'll try anything. And they're very open to, again, and it's a fairly science-based community. So they tend to, like what you're talking about, try to find some actual rationality in the things that they're choosing, but they'll try lots of stuff. So it's kind of interesting, like your journey. I've heard from, do you know who Chris Kresser is?
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, very similar journey. Like he got some type of infection traveling in Asia, and then the antibiotics destroyed his immune system response or whatever. And then he had to go back through to figure out what had happened by himself. And that's what got him into, you know, alternative health. So I think that storyline of I had a bad experience that nobody could help me with is a really potent one.
Definitely. It definitely is. And also it gets me thinking about just, you know, how both the Western medicine and the alternative medicine camps, they both have their strengths and limitations. And I wouldn't say that either is without any fault. But you know, on both sides, you do sometimes see like cherry picking of data, like, you know, only selecting studies that support our viewpoint. And I think we have to be like really careful when we are, you know, evaluating the data on something, not to just, you know, kind of, you know, be looking at data that, you know, reinforces our pre-existing biases, but also be willing to consider that, you know, maybe some of the ideas that we have, some of the thoughts that we have based on our experiences, you know, they might not be the whole picture. And I think that one thing that's so interesting is that, you know, we as humans, we're so susceptible to the power of anecdote, even at the expense of empirical evidence. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why we would trust Yelp reviews from our friends more than like a Zagat rating from some elitist organization to which we have no personal connection. And I think it's just like the fact that with anecdote, you have like this human element, and that makes things a little bit more tangible for us because like we feel like it's more warm and personal. It's not cold and clinical the way data is sometimes. And I think that's like a real challenge when you're trying to educate people in the scientific community on how to like communicate with, you know, and get across their ideas to a general audience. You kind of want to, like the things that, you know, the way that we define rigor in science, like we have like this pyramid of you know, the hierarchy of evidence. And at the top, you have like very high quality meta-analyses and randomized controlled trials. But, you know, appealing to that data, it might not be what works best in a general audience. And you might have to use the power of anecdote or use other powers of persuasion to get your point across so that it's more tangible, because, you know, you might have all this data, but then it's like, what is the end result? What are we using this data to accomplish? And can we use this information to improve the quality of life or achieve some other end goal? So I think it's just interesting, because like the things that we, you know, kind of cling to, the things that we like define as rigor in science, like we have something called the Bradford Hill criteria, which helps us to define causality. Those things, they might not serve as well as a purpose when we're just trying to communicate to a lay audience and explain the importance of our research or whatever it is that we're doing.
Yeah, it's so many cool issues in this stuff when I start uncovering it for persuasion. When I was in the paleo community, I was a panelist a few times at Paleo FX here in Austin. And I would always come away with the same thing. And usually I would say it during my panels about, you're all scientists, you're all health people. Why are you trying to do persuasion? Like, none of you are trained in persuasion. And it drives me crazy as a rhetorician to hear you try to persuade with blunt instruments, essentially. You know, it'd be like watching you do surgery, or me watching you do surgery with sticks. Like, you guys really need to bring some rhetoricians in here and up the game on what you're doing. And even what you're talking about, like, you know, in between, like there's a rhetoric of science, and there are people who study sort of how science convinces itself that it's correct. And that's kind of what you're talking about. This idea of rigor, it is just a linguistic structure, you know, and it's backed up by all this numerical proof, but it's just construction. And that doesn't mean it's right or wrong, but it just means it is constructed, and you have to buy into the foundational concepts of the construct in order to accept it. And so you can look at what's problem, how rhetoric or science deceives itself. And then the thing I was trying to talk to them about, which was, hey, all you scientists don't know how to talk to regular people. You know, even use anecdotes. Anecdotes are natural. Every human being tells anecdotes. No human being does data. Like, without computers, that doesn't exist, that kind of huge data. And so it's unnatural, even though you work in it all the time. And so using natural human communication, just that as a concept, I don't think people really understand sometimes from the science community.
Definitely. And I think it kind of also goes back to the way of wanting to kind of write the way we speak, because a lot of the time the language that we use is very esoteric, and, you know, it's full of jargon that is not necessarily accessible. So also just kind of like breaking things down to a level where it's elementary, so that, you know, even a, you know, a young person, 5 years old, can understand. It kind of like brings me back to, I think it might've been like either Einstein or Feynman who'd said, like, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. So I think it's also a challenge for us, like, you know, if we're not able to dissect things into language that anyone can understand, maybe we don't fully understand the research that we're doing ourselves even. So it's also like a self-reflection thing. It's not just, can we communicate effectively, but do we understand it deep enough?
Yeah, and it's both, right? Like, I notice, again, most smart people who are doing science and things like that, they learn how to write and that, but they're not communication trained. Almost nobody gets the training that I went through with even communication studies, and then, you know, advance it again into rhetoric, you know, this sort of hyper control of communication. And so it's unfair, I think, to expect them to be able to do it. Like, somehow we're just naturally agile. One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on the podcast is you're very verbally agile with all these super tech medical concepts. You flow through them very quickly, and you're very articulate about it. And when I run into people like that, I'm like, oh, that's a very useful skill in the world that you're working in, but still being able to talk outside of that world. Like, you'd probably have to bring down a lot of your terminology and the sort of the level of, that you're talking about. But once you have verbal agility, you can make those moves back to basic calm pretty easily. It can be trained. But to expect technical people and medical people to be great communicators is just a fallacy.
Yeah, I agree. I think definitely that training is important. And I think without it, we're kind of missing out on, like, you know, the primary purpose for why we do research in the first place, because, like, I think discovery is essentially meaningless unless it's communicated and disseminated widely. And unless you can communicate it to, you know, the general public or to, you know, investors, if you're pitching something, or, you know, to clinicians when you're trying to show the utility of your idea, it won't get adopted and it won't really make a difference, like, at a societal level. So I feel like that communication skill, it's not just like a frill, it's necessary for the advancement of science.
Yeah, when I work with businesses, a lot of times I always try to do some foundational work so they can sort of see why, if they don't get the meta concepts and strategies down, they'll completely fail downstream. And one is to break things into information. Here's your information, which for most people is highly jumbled and incomplete. And here's your communication. Like, you want to hand stuff over to me to turn into great communication, because that's what I'm getting hired to do. But if you hand me sloppy information that's confused, I can't turn into good communication. And so those are very separate camps. And so I think understanding that, oh yeah, there's a bifurcation here, and your downstream work will fail in either camp. Yes, you need great information and great researchers. You also need great communicators to translate that stuff. And so sometimes I have to struggle with businesses to make them value the communication camp as much as the information camp, you know, and the tech and the build and all that. I'm like, that's great. I know it's hard. I know it's hard to do software, but if you don't do great communication, that's just as good. It's like, you know, it's like you said, it's just going to sit there.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
So do you do in your job, do you do mostly talking to investors and sort of people who are steeped in your background, or are you talking to sort of lay people who need to understand the basics of these concepts?
We do both. So we do reach out to like OBGYNs and functional medicine practitioners, anybody who might be able to implement our services into their own practice. But then we also do a lot of community outreach, which is just, you know, mothers and, you know, families who are expecting children or wanting to conceive, and they just want to give their children the best possible start in life by ensuring their gut microbiome health. We talk to a lot of lay people and try to explain the importance of, you know, of microbiome health for the mom during pregnancy, and like how much of her health is transferable to her child via her microbes. So yeah, we're definitely, we do try to be as accessible as possible and to communicate things in a way that anyone can understand, but, you know, also in a way that's kind of like showing the importance of these things and how they can affect disease risk in the long term, and in terms of like your risk of developing like atopic diseases like allergies or asthma, as well as affecting your risk for, you know, diabetes, obesity, things like that later down the road, because just so much of it is kind of foundational, and so much of like our early life experiences set us up for success health-wise later down the road.
Do you guys use any cultural comparisons? Like the way other cultures have done this? I know one of the things in paleo that's big is to compare this to, you know, sort of tribal cultures and much earlier cultures and the way they did health and food and stuff like that. I'm trying to remember the organization that does this, but essentially they go and try to recover all the old ways of preparing food, like grains and things like that. Because it, you know, has been adapted over eons for humans to eat like that, versus the way, you know, science just sort of throws food on our plate. Do you do comparisons to the way other cultures take care of the biome?
I mean, we do kind of like take into account the way that other cultures might tend to their biomes, because like there's all sorts of like fermented foods across cultures. Like, you know, Germans have sauerkraut. There's miso in Japanese culture. There's lots of different, there's nixtamalized corn tortillas in some Latin American cultures. So there's definitely like lots of different ways you can perform fermentation. So I think that's something that is kind of common across cultures, like the idea of fermentation. And, you know, I mean, this happens to be something that can be beneficial for your gut microbiome, but they had originally done it as a way as a way for to preserve food in the long term. But the other thing is, like, when it comes to cultural discussions, we also have to be very sensitive, because a lot of scientific advice might conflict with cultural practices. Like, for example, in certain cultures, it's customary to give certain medicines or liquids before a mom starts breastfeeding. And like, as far as, you know, ensuring breastfeeding success, it's best for a baby's first meal to be mother's breast milk. And so a lot of discussions around parenthood and breastfeeding are very sensitive. So approaching those with nuance and understanding ends up being really important for us, because while breastfeeding is absolutely paramount for health, not all women and not all mothers are able to do that. For various reasons, there could be like time constraints, or a woman might've had a mastectomy and she's unable to breastfeed. So we just want to be very sensitive and say that, you know, you're doing a great job, you know, just by trying to ensure the health of your child. And like, these are the options that are available to you if breastfeeding is not an option. Like, if you're able to pump during the day and, you know, provide milk that way, there's also donor banks that sometimes provide breast milk, things like that. If you absolutely have to formula feed, there are formulas that integrate HMOs, which are like sugars that help feed beneficial bacteria in the baby gut. So we're just kind of like trying to, you know, give people any, you know, all the options and like have them decide what works best with their beliefs and their lifestyle, and, you know, whatever works best for you is like the, you know, and whatever you're doing, it is, you know, it's, it will be appreciated. So.
Yeah. It's an interesting, again, from a rhetorical standpoint, that's kind of a safe retreat. I see a lot of people, when they're especially doing public health or public advice, stand up on the shelf of, we're trying to give you good information, but we respect whatever your decision is, because it's a safe moral stance, safer politically and things like that. It's not what actually people believe. It's not really what the scientists believe. They're taking a political position that they think will get the message accepted better, you know, across cultures, or keep them from getting, you know, too much blowback or flack from, you know, cultural sources. Again, as a rhetorician, you're trying to design messaging that gets what you want into the world, right? As much of it as possible. And you have to factor in damage, you know, and things when you're actually, you know, working against your larger purposes. But it does, it really adjusts the way you have to do the messaging. And in some ways dilutes the offer, right?
Yeah, it can, because, you know, on the one hand, you want to convey the message that breastfeeding is best, but it's also not possible for everyone. So, yeah, I mean, like, definitely the more exceptions that you include, you know, the more convoluted the message gets. So I guess there's this trade-off between, you know, giving sound advice and being inclusive, and kind of like finding the balance between the two sometimes.
Yeah, that balance is hard these days. I know in comedy, you know, there's this tension now about comedians doing things that go into insensitive areas. And there was a video I saw the other day of a woman who got upset about something a comedian said on stage during a stand-up show. And so she just went and stood up on the stage and wouldn't leave because she was offended. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. But, you know, like, is that the place to be making your political social issue stance in a comedy club? And a lot of I think what's happened with social justice, like, it's become such a strong aesthetic in the world, especially in America, to stand up and say something. Now people feel like they're empowered to say it, even in those kind of situations when it's not really working in your favor. You know, it's just interrupting the experience. And I could see that with the things that y'all are fighting through, like, you know, if you were giving perfect advice, like, here's what it would be, right? And then you start chipping away at it so that you can make adjustments for people that can't quite do that, that, you know, can still get 75% of the benefit or whatever. And so you kind of, I guess, organize your messaging along those lines, like, here's the perfect thing down to 75 to 50, you know, that's kind of the way I would organize it in my head. So, like, go back to the I forgot that you guys did the maternal stuff, which I think is the core of your business at Tiny Health. Is that right?
Yeah. We actually sequence three types of samples. So we do baby gut, mom gut, and then mom vaginal samples.
And do you like, what do people get from those samples? Like what kind of information do they get?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, traditionally, like the older methods of, quantifying bacteria in a sample used to be through culture. So we do something different called shotgun metagenomics. And the advantages are that you can sequence not only the bacteria in a sample, but also any of the eukaryotic DNA, which would include things like fungi, viruses, protists. So you get a lot more information than just bacteria. And because it's culture independent, we can also culture bacteria that, you know, might not grow very well on a specific medium. Because like with a petri dish, it's very dependent on like, you know, the medium that you used, how long you cultured. So we don't have any of those restrictions. And so basically what happens is when somebody orders a kit, they take their respective sample, whether it's a stool or vaginal sample, they'll send it into the lab. The lab will process the sample, we'll get the results back, and then we'll feed them through our pipelines to and analyze what type of organisms, microorganisms are in the sample. And then we will also give recommendations when necessary. So we're basically just trying to ensure optimal vaginal and gut health for the mom during pregnancy, as well as tracking the first 1,000 days of life for the baby, which would be the point of conception up to 2 years of age, because that's often considered the critical window of opportunity during which a lot of disease risk is established.
So you're making super babies.
Yeah. I mean, we're just basically trying to ensure the best start to life as possible. So
I like super babies. Let's say get your baby got so strong, super baby.
True, but I feel like super babies might have like this sort of eugenics connotation to it. And I definitely don't want to give people the wrong impression.
Yeah, I get it. Like everybody, it's so funny. Again, there's so many landmines, right? Culturally and socially and historically, that it's so hard to do public messaging and not step on a landmine.
That's true. I think some of them, you know, you don't even know that they're there and you might accidentally step on one.
I've done it many times. Like I taught cultural studies. That was a secondary, my PhD, and I taught it quite a bit. And I would step on landmines with students all the time because, you know, it's a class of 50 people and they all come from different cultures and different beliefs. And I remember showing a documentary called Hoop Dreams once in one of my classes. And I was like, I really enjoyed this. I think it's interesting. It goes back and forth between black and white and sort of wealth classes and, you know, the Catholic school versus the public school and all this. And there were two, African-American girls in my class, and this was a very, very white college that we were all at. And they both got really upset and came up to me afterwards. And I'm like, well, what's the deal? They're like, because it just shows every shot of the black community as they're dancing and, you know, and like, then it goes to the white community. It's like, it's so stereotypical. And I'm like, I never even saw that. Like I saw it exploring these two cultures and I'm like, but you're right. That's exactly constructed like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think you have that feedback, you know, you'll always have that feedback regardless of what piece of art that you're talking about. I remember when like Slumdog Millionaire came out, a lot of people were a little critical that it only seemed to show like the slums of India and like it was painting it as a country that was only defined by poverty. And the really interesting thing about India is that, you know, depending on where you go, it almost seems that it's not the same country because there can just be so much disparity in terms of wealth, in terms of like so many different things. Like a lot of cities like Delhi are fairly westernized and, you know, an American might feel more at home in a city like that versus, you know, some of the more rural areas where you do see a lot of poverty and like the standard of living is very different. And that, you know, I think one of the things that we as Westerners often have kind of ingrained into us is that rural living is necessarily inferior. Like in some ways, like, you know, I think some things should be always accessible regardless of, you know, what your choices are, like, you know, access to clean water. I think that should always be a priority, things like that. But I mean, like not having access to modern conveniences, is that necessarily like, does that necessarily confer like a lower standard of living? Because like so much of this is a bit of a tangent at this point, but
sorry, I like tangents.
Basically, I'm sort of thinking about the idea of happiness and how much of it is relative, because in a lot of these rural areas, the neighbors and everyone, they all have access to the same standard of life. So, you know, even if it is a little more, it requires more labor to perform certain tasks that we could perform with a machine over here. Like everyone has that standard of living. So, you know, you're comparing yourself to your neighbors and everyone has about the same amount. So everyone's happy. And then I think in the West, like the thing is, we know more about what other people have because of technology. And we're like, so like wired into what everyone else is doing in different parts of the country. And so I think the opportunities for comparison are greater. And so the opportunity for discontent is greater too, because you're just, yeah, there's just, you know, more. And I guess it's sort of like that ignorance is bliss concept. Like, you know, if I'm only aware of like what's in my provincial surroundings, maybe I won't be as unhappy or something.
Yeah, I one of the comedy writing tools is to take established sayings and then tag another clause to them. So that ignorance is bliss, I tagged once with ignorance is bliss unless it's working at the cubicle next to you. Then it's kind of annoying. But yeah, I think you're right. You know, especially when you start doing public messaging and you start getting the responses that you get, like I had friends that worked for WIC for a long time and works in the same area of maternal health and food and things like that in a very different way. You know, it's a poverty organization. But the same messaging challenges, like how do you message to that population? Like, can you message, you can't message across the full range of classes and education levels and cultures and things like that with a high level terminology that, you know, they haven't accessed yet, right? So like with your stuff, like even when we launched in and you started talking about like fecal transplant, most people on earth have not heard of that concept, right? Like it's still a very new technology. It's not like you walk into your GP office and they're like, here, take this, you know, pop this, you know, fecal pill and you'll be fine. It's just not in the cultural lingo yet. And so I can see a lot of translation challenges for you guys so that you get this sort of really interesting new technology. And it sounds like your read of the gut biome and, you know, all the different reads that you can do are way more advanced than what I knew from, you know, the people I knew that were doing that kind of stuff in paleo. But how do you take that super advanced stuff and move it down to the level of, you know, where you don't come across as elitist and you don't use that terminology and that medical stuff so that you can still reach that audience? I would guess you guys are, you know, feel challenged by that a lot.
Definitely. Yeah. And we definitely do try to pay a lot of attention to just how we're creating content and how we're delivering the message, because yeah, it's like you're saying, like the communication is just as effective as like the R&D. It's just as important as the R&D. And if you're just not able to kind of, you know, tell people like, so what, then it doesn't matter. It's like, what is the point of what you're doing? Like, what's the end goal? What's the purpose? How is this going to better my life in some way or add value?
And I think like, you know, all this blow up that's gone over the last couple of weeks about Big Bird getting vaccinated, right? That's a strategy for taking very traditional culture characters from child cartoon culture and using them to do pretty grown up persuasion. And, you know, like my kids grew up on Baby Einstein and, you know, I remember Baby Mozart and all these different things, basically fusing high culture or high intellectualism down into the cartoons in very, very safe, you know, simple ways. But at least, you know, Mozart, you know, in babyhood, at least those things were merged in those cartoons and it gave you some options for doing that kind of merger messaging, which I think you guys have to do.
Definitely. And I, you know, I don't really like the idea of like highbrow versus lowbrow art. You know, that, you know, some people will say that, you know, Renaissance paintings are highbrow and then like comic books are lowbrow art. But I personally feel that, you know, Calvin and Hobbes are like one of the best sources of wisdom, at least for me, as just.
Literally, Calvin and Hobbes were literally Enlightenment, you know, philosophers. And so he fused those two worlds very well.
Definitely, definitely. So I definitely do think that, you know, there is a lot to be said for like merging the worlds and kind of like bringing those two together, like whatever it is that you're doing, whether it's like, you know, classical music and like children's TV shows, or if it's comic books and philosophy. I think the more that you can merge, like the more you'll be expanding the audience that finds your message accessible.
When I look at, when I come across sort of interesting, difficult communication challenges, like taking super tech, new advances in tech, and getting it widely accepted into the culture, especially for in an area where people are as sensitive as they are about baby health and motherhood, you know, they don't take a lot of new information or conflicting information well. I remember looking at some of this stuff when I was first a parent and trying to figure out like, so what to expect when you're expecting, right? Became somehow the book that was super accepted, and it was everywhere. Everybody that got their first baby, they would bring that text, that piece of rhetoric, you know, into their world. And, you know, there are other ones before that. It was, I guess, the Dr. Spock series, you know, in my, you know, earlier generations. And so everybody's looking for really good information, but the challenge of creating good communication texts that can do that it's a real challenge.
Definitely, 100%.
So what I'm saying is, are you going to make a cartoon?
We might. We are trying to integrate animations and things that are just that kind of like put a voice and like a picture to some of the concepts that we're working with. Just kind of like showing you how the mom's microbes transfer to baby so that it's like a more tangible concept, things like that.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that a little bit, sort of go into some of the science there, because again, you know, you get this sort of little shards of this, and they're usually story shards, right? Like C-section babies. You'll get this little piece of quasi-science will flow through the media and it'll stick. So C-section babies are not as healthy as, you know, naturally delivered babies. Is that true? Like, is that a useful kind of, you know, cultural belief once it gets out there that you guys can operate off of, or?
Microbe transfer is generally a little bit more effective in the case of a vaginal birth versus a C-section birth. Now, there's certain associations, like the risk of asthma, for example, or allergies tends to be higher in babies born by C-section versus vaginal birth, but that doesn't mean that the C-section is causing it. So we can't make that statement. But the other thing is quite interesting is like, even if you do have a C-section birth, breastfeeding can often rescue anything that happened, anything that was lost, that lost opportunity for transfer. That transfer can still happen if a mother breastfeeds, because she does transfer lots of microbes through the action of breastfeeding alone. So it's not as though, you know, everything is doomed if you have to have a C-section, an emergency one, or if you're even having a scheduled one for some, you know, for personal reasons. Breastfeeding can help a lot. And it, you know, after a certain number of months, a breastfed baby can resemble, you know, the same microbiome health as a vaginally birthed baby who was breastfed. So it's not as though all hope is lost. And like, you know, at any given stage, there are still interventions that you can take to kind of restore health and get back to baseline. So, you know, parents shouldn't have like this idea that it's, you know, like my baby's health is like, you know, set in stone now, like I can't do anything to reverse it. There's still lots of options and opportunities to kind of, you know, get your child's health back on track. So I definitely, you know, I wouldn't want parents to kind of approach the journey with a sense of fear or like a sense of like, we, you know, wanting to avoid making the wrong decisions. I think, you know, whatever is in the best health, whatever's like in the best interest of the health of the both mom and baby, just go that route and like, you know, take it as it comes and just know that the microbiome is very malleable. So you can very much fix things if they get off track because of like an ear infection and baby has to like take antibiotics. Like you can get it back on track if need be.
Yeah. So who are the technical people that you all are trying to get your message to? I would, you know, assume doctors, OBGYNs. Are you also doing like midwives and the alternative community and stuff like that? Like, are you just sort of strafing the entire, you know, baby industry?
Yeah, we do work with, you know, midwives and, you know, people who are a little more holistic in thinking, people who do kind of accept the importance of the microbiome for health in general, just because it is such a nascent field right now. So we are kind of relying on, you know, fellow microbiome appreciators to kind of disperse our message and help us get the word out there. But that's our market outreach for the time being.
What do you call a biological researcher? Do you guys have terms and labels and names yet, like characters?
We're not really big on labels as such.
Labels in a good way, like the way that when you tell a story that people are like, oh, that's an OBGYN, you know, that's a label for a doc, you know, but is there a gut biome label for a doc?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, obviously, like, you know, people can get their PhD in microbiology, but like microbiome science seems to be a slightly separate unit just because the way most microbiology is taught, it's still very pathogen focused. So it still very much focuses on like how microbes are dangerous and they need to be obliterated. And we need to like stop the threat of antibiotic resistance, which is a very real problem, very important. But it's just that, you know, a lot of microbiology education, it doesn't take into account the knowledge of the past couple decades, which is kind of like, you know, this very new way of thinking about microbes and the way that the vast majority are beneficial for our health. We should tend our inner gardens to kind of like maintain our health and like, you know, they are necessary for digestion, that they help with immunity and, you know, perform all of these very necessary functions for us. So like that has not really been fully integrated into microbiology education as of now. At least when I was in school, it was very much pathogen focused, and I was in school pretty recently. So I don't think it's really made its way. We never talked about the microbiome, let alone the fact that they can be beneficial. It was very much focusing on pathogens like, you know, things that cause Shigella, Salmonella, E. coli that causes food poisoning, things like that, which is interesting because, you know, the vast majority of E. coli are also friendly. There's just a few strains that can cause food poisoning.
Yeah, isn't it fascinating how so much health is, I get it, because again, in persuasion, suffering is an incredible force of motivation. Like if you want to sell something to somebody, sell to somebody in pain, because they're very motivated to get out of pain. So it's one of the primary areas of human endeavor is to avoid and get out of suffering. And I could understand why medicine was driven that way. Like that's what people are paying for. If you have a toothache, you have to get this taken care of right now, right? So it makes sense that it was driven that way based on sort of servicing a community. So I think now like what's happening with companies like yours and you know, these sort of sub areas of the industry, moving it back over to this idea of, well, let's create holistic health. Persuasion breaks everything into dystopia and utopia. That's one of my favorite bifurcations when I teach people how to do messaging in this. Here's all the good things that you could get, right? If you've learned about the biome and you follow our stuff, here's all the bad things that are going to happen if you don't. And the human brain organizes really well across utopia, dystopia. It's a really clean, you know, sort of, oh yeah, I avoid this and I go towards this. But a lot of times you find if you don't have the one on the right, if you don't have dystopia, you can't get people to believe in the utopia. So like you and where we started about have a horrible experience, you know, that you went through that's based in exactly what you're working in now. That kind of dystopian experience is really motivating for a long time. Right. It will definitely really get you to behave in certain ways and not in others.
Definitely. Yeah. It is a very motivating force, especially when it affects your quality of life so substantially. And I get what you're saying about like the bifurcation between dystopia and utopia, in the way that, you know, I think one of the reasons that the human brain is kind of more primed to remember negative experiences is, you know, it's kind of like evolutionarily ingrained. And so definitely the desire to avoid pain is very, very primed. And I think that's something that it makes sense because like you kind of don't want to repeat certain things. And I think that is one of the reasons that we have a tendency to kind of preferentially remember negative memories more than positive, just the desire to not repeat those things. And it's kind of interesting. A lot of our biology follows that pattern as well. This is a bit of a tangent again, but bacteria, they actually, the CRISPR technology, which you might have heard about, which focuses on gene editing, that comes from bacteria. So bacteria have that system. And in essence, it's kind of like a form of adaptive immunity in the way that it gives bacteria a record of the pathogens that previously invaded them. So for example, bacteriophages, they're a type of virus that can invade and infect a bacteria. And most phages, they're specific to one host. So they can only infect one particular strain of bacteria. And what CRISPR does is that it kind of takes like this DNA mugshot of the viral invader and it incorporates it into its own DNA. So that's what the gene editing technique that we use is based on. It's based off of that bacterial system. And so basically it's like the bacteria's way of keeping a record of all these past offenses so that should that same phage come back, it will be ready and primed to attack and make sure that it's not able to cause any collateral damage this time around. So it's
it is the same thing, right? It's everything is figuring out how to take, if you survive the predator the first time, how to take it out or defend against it the second time. Like what doesn't kill you the first time, you need to get ready for it because it's going to come back and try again.
Definitely. Yeah. And like we do that, you know, with our memories psychologically too, just like keeping a record. And it kind of just reminds me when people say like the body never forgets any past traumas or, you know, things that harmed it. It will always want to keep that on record should it encounter those same problems again.
Yeah. And I maybe I need to do evolutionary based rhetoric appeal to people because it is the strongest pattern of if people have been in pain, then it's a good offer to first get them out of pain and then move them to the utopian space of you won't have that pain again, you know, because you are now protected against it. And I think that's at the core of what you guys are offering with the maternal stuff is that if you do the best you can, do as much as you can to get your baby up and going, they've got their best shot at avoiding pain and suffering and disease and all this stuff later on. And that's the core pitch, right? So it's avoiding dystopia by maximizing as much utopia as you can. And I think you're right where you're worried about trying to make everybody live up to the perfect utopia, then you make everybody anxious and, you know, I'll never get there. And it's okay to not get all the way there. You're still getting a lot of the benefits, but ultimately that, I think that pitch of there's a lot of danger out there for your baby and for human beings. Let's maximize your protection as much as possible. Pretty strong pair.
Yeah. And I think what's kind of maybe challenging about this particular pitch is that it's based on prevention. And a lot of healthcare revolves around the idea that, you know, we will only intervene once a problem manifests or presents itself with symptoms, or at, you know, once it's progressed to a point where intervention seems necessary, because a lot of the time, you know, we have like this kind of like monitor and watch to see what happens kind of approach, rather than kind of like proactively or just kind of, you know, jumping in ahead of time to make sure that it doesn't progress or get to the point where you might need some, you know, more invasive intervention. You know, just because I think American healthcare especially is very much based on this like diagnose and then drug paradigm. And, you know, anything outside of that, it's almost as though it doesn't have a place. Like how often will your doctor ask you about your lifestyle or diet or exercise habits at your checkup? It's mostly
they won't leave me alone. He calls me every other week. It's like, are you out there exercising? Like, yeah. No, it is. It's not in the model at all. And I think, you know, when we were talking about that earlier, it is because of the way it was grown up to deal with pain and suffering and disease and things like that. And that's what economically makes the most sense to a healthcare industry, is that you can charge people a lot when they have cancer, you know? So a lot of people are doing research on cancer. You can, you know, if COVID's coming around, you can sell an awful lot of vaccines. And not in a cynical way. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's almost natural, especially in a capitalist culture, to go where the money is. And the money is where the people are suffering the most, because they'll pay the most and they'll balk the least at paying. Whereas like what you guys are doing really is, it's still an esoteric pitch. Like, you have to convince people there is pain, abstract pain possible for your baby or suffering. And we can help you avoid that. But it's an abstraction. So it's not a concrete suffering. It's an abstract suffering.
Very true. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because it's like you're trying to avoid suffering in the future, but you don't know if it would or wouldn't come. So,
yeah. And that's why I said, like, so many people who work in the alternative health space have a similar story to yours, of they had a concrete, ongoing, very difficult to diagnose situation. I've got a buddy who gets some type of chemical exposure. At least that was his theory, and it just destroyed him, like everything. Like, he couldn't neurologically process, and he eventually moved to a cabin in Montana or somewhere. He had such allergies to everything, and spent 3 years in isolation. And his ultimate savior, his exit out of it, at least according to him, was through things like meditation and, you know, sort of more body awareness, and through that path. And some guru that he ran into was, you know, taught him through that, and he recovered. And so you tell people stuff like that, and if you haven't been through it, they look at you like you're crazy, right? Because they're like, this isn't my experience. I haven't seen that happen. It doesn't connect in an easy, concrete way, the way, hey, you have a headache, take this pill. It's such a nice, clean, concrete connection. And, you know, half hour later, you can't feel the headache as much. And so I think when you see alternative stuff like you guys, super important to figure out how to get it into the world, because it does have, like you're saying, the massive upsides of avoiding the actual suffering. Super babies, still super babies.
Yeah, super healthy babies.
Yeah. These pathogens can't get to your baby. Your baby has been Simonized, or, you know, from the inside out. Their garden is strong.
Yeah, they are. Yes.
The garden is strong in this one.
Yes. That's good. We should borrow that sometime.
Yeah, go for it. It's fascinating to me, like, when I run into people that are really doing cool stuff. And that's why I was like, I need to talk to you. Because I always want to be like, yeah, let's get this into the world, right? Get this in the world. I would never have heard of you guys probably, and unless we'd randomly met each other on Lunch Club.
True. Yeah. Thank you, Universe, for setting that up.
So, awesome. Well, this has been super fun. I really appreciate you jumping on. I know I kind of grab things and turn into rhetoric all the time, but your stuff's really fascinating. So,
yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for having me. And also thank you for, like, you know, teaching me about the importance of rhetoric, because this is like, I feel like it's its own discipline. And if I hadn't met you, I would not have known that it has like this very kind of like separate like curriculum almost to it.
Yeah,
and that you had a PhD in it. That was interesting to me as well. I wasn't aware.
Yeah, I try to hook people with that. It's kind of my next thing is to start a rhetoric think tank, like to actually get it where people in public policy use this stuff. There was a big study that came out last week on from the Aspen Institute about, it's like an 80 page study, 6 months, multi-million dollars, with 20 different experts on social media and public discourse, misinformation. What do we do about misinformation? High level stuff, not a single rhetorician on the team. And I'm like, rhetoricians study public discourse. The rest of you don't. You may study journalism, little variations and things like that, but why don't you get some rhetoricians on that team?
True. I mean, the rest of us, we're just speculating. Like, we don't have any like hard evidence to back anything up. We're just like, I think this is probably going to be the most effective way, but we don't know the way a rhetorician would.
Yeah. It's fun to be able to run across things and sort of pair up where you can be like, oh, I've got an expertise that might help here. And like with you, you know, I know what the gut, like there's a story I read very early about the gut biome stuff and the fecal transplants of some researcher, with a turkey baster in, in Africa. And I'm like, that's the kind of rhetorical story power you need to convince people like, what? Yeah.
True.
He implanted himself with a turkey baster, right? Do you know that story? You know that story. Yes,
I'm familiar with that. I think, he had been running the Human Food Project and that particular blog. Yes. I have mixed feelings about it because like one, it does really catch your attention. But two, like, you know, when we talk about FMT, we also want to focus on like the safety of it. And, you know, what he did is not terribly safe. Like you wouldn't want someone to do that in like their home and just like, kind of like, you know.
Yeah. Like drinking bleach, like when Trump was like, yeah, drink bleach, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, if you are going to go through that procedure, you do want to make sure your donor is rigorously tested and you do want to use all sterile equipment. Preferably do not do it with a turkey baster. I would recommend against that. So, I mean, I think stories like that, you know, they sometimes do a disservice to our field just because they kind of, they don't really kind of highlight how much we stress safety and as well as efficacy. And it sort of seems like, you know, like this basement underground protocol when it is very potentially life-saving in so many cases, especially in, you know, the setting of C. difficile colitis, which can often be deadly for a lot of people. And I think it just kind of like glosses over, you know, how powerful it is when done properly. It kind of like relegates it to the, you know, to the realm of the insane or something.
Well, it's funny. Again, I could take you back through the rhetoric stuff with it, but I designed this thing because I deal this with businesses all the time. Businesses are very conservative about what they want to say about their product because they don't want something like that out there to become the tsunami that everybody thinks of when they think of their product, right? So they're afraid of these kind of high potent, high media bait, high memorable, salacious kind of things. The problem with that is that if you actually look at what persuasion needs as far as getting people all the way down to a conversion, that there's this persuasion corridor where you can give people the safety messages and the actual information and all that kind of stuff. But you've got to get them in the corridor first. And you'd only do that in the media. The media is only going to cover you if you have crazy stories like that. And so for awareness, you need sort of high kinetic, really vivid, crazy, unique stories, characters and all that. But then once you move them into the corridor, you got to slow it all down and be like, okay, that's great that you know about the guy on the African plains who, you know, put a turkey baster up his butt. But now let's take a look at what the actual product is and still move them through. But it's this weird, you know, double challenge that people have about their public messaging that you've got to hook people. And then you've got to slowly, you know, also move them to respecting your product and paying for it, you know, because that's the last part of the corridor. You have to move people from interested and everything else to willing to pay the amount of money that you want to charge for your product. Mm-hmm. And so all that kind of stage messaging, that pipeline messaging, it can go wrong at any stage. But if you give me just boring stuff up front, like as a creative, I'm like, I can't do anything with that. You know, like it has to have awareness potential. Then you got to fade that, move people, and then all the way down to sales. But it is a challenge to not stain your entire product with that crazy story.
Definitely, definitely. And also in our space, there's been, you know, some instances where a lack of medical due diligence led to issues, as was the case in Ubiome and like the insurance fraud that happened over there. So oftentimes, like, you know, when others in your space have had some sort of like negative publicity, that reflects on you as well, for better or for worse. And also with like the Theranos scandal, and people are definitely a little bit more on edge about new technologies and wanting to make sure that whatever that they're investing in, you know, is legitimate, that the technology is sound, that the team is competent. And I think like, hopefully, you know, those things that are really trying to actually, you know, contribute something useful will still be able to make it. But yeah, it does affect the rest of the players in the space, even those that are only like, you know, tangentially related in a way.
Yeah, it's you guys are in a tough space. I mean, because you're in a complicated, it's a complicated product. So you have to do a lot of sort of explanation rhetoric. And it's also scam heavy, your industry. Like, and so you have to prove that you're not a scam. Everybody starts with the idea that if it's medical and they've never heard of it before, that it's scam.
Yeah. Like guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah. And that's American, you know, American capitalism has done that to us, because the second level of American capitalism is all scam, right? And we're all used to seeing it. We all know it's out there. It's constantly trying to take our identities at the gas pump, you know? And so we know it's there. And so that's, you know, you've got to build rhetoric and that proves you're not scam. And I think like you guys have a really nice website and things like that and smart people, and you have team that has credentials and all that stuff. If people actually look at that, they instantly go, well, they don't seem like a scam, you know? But it's always, that specter is always there when you're dealing with health products.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that's another reason why we do want to lean on the rigor of the process so heavily, just to kind of prove that, you know.
Yeah, I get it. That's the answer is always, let's up our credibility, our expertise credibility, right? Yeah. And I'm like, well, rhetorically, sure. But people, you know, basically bail out very quickly on your expertise rhetoric because they can't read it. They don't really know what all those terms mean. So you find a lot of health companies end up with like incredibly complicated websites and complicated messaging that's really information dominant, and nobody reads it. And yeah. I'm like, yeah, so that's not really doing what you think it's doing. You want to turn that off. You want to turn that scam, you know, suspicion off, but you don't really do it with heavy, you know, bombardment of expertise. It seems like maybe you would, but it doesn't really work that way. And psychologically for people.
Yeah, true. I mean, if your audience doesn't have the ability to evaluate that rigor, then it's useless, essentially.
I run into this all the time. Like on my bio, it says master rhetorician. And I put that rhetorician word there as a speed bump, psychological speed bump, because people they don't know how to say it. They've almost never seen that word. They don't even know if it's a real word. And then I have rhetoric PhD and they don't know if that's real either. So it gets them into a mystery space. So I've got an emotional reaction in my first four words. And then it gets them into an amusement space because I have them try to say it, or they try to say it. So it's kind of fun to start, but I've built script that can very quickly give them simpler versions of it. I'm like, rhetoric is the old Greek word for persuasion. That's literally where it comes from. And so the Greeks studied, you know, all forms of persuasion. So when I translate it down like that, I get the emotional effects and I simplify it. So now they, you know, can sort of process it with me, and then I can build up the complexity again if I want to. But it's again, these little rhetoric games to get your, you know, particular type of messaging massaged into the American brain or the culture that you're talking to. It's endless, you know, the way you do that massaging.
Definitely. I do think that, you know, the link to persuasion makes it a lot more tangible. And it kind of reminds me of like this one section from 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene, where he's talking about how everyone plays for power, whether you're doing it consciously or unconsciously, because if you didn't play for power at all, you'd be frustrated because, you know, you're always at the mercy of everyone else and you have no real control or autonomy over your life. And, you know, like he was even talking about how like, if you're arguing that you're very transparent, that you're honest and earnest, and like, you know, you're not trying to be manipulative, even that's a power play because you gain people's trust more easily by being transparent. And so everyone plays for power. Everyone tries to persuade one way or another.
Yeah. It's supernatural to human beings. You have to persuade, and everything on the planet has to persuade. Like little things have to persuade big things not to eat them. You know, it's like the changing of colors of things on the ocean floor so that they're disguised, so they don't look like something that's edible. We are constantly, it's because we live on a multi-planet. There's always things around us that want to eat us or harm us or, you know, be in our space or whatever. And so you have to come up with strategies for dealing with other things. And persuasion is nice because it's just verbal. Like you do these negotiations, you gain power, in the safest way possible with is just with words. You don't have to punch somebody. You can say the right word and they're like, I think I'll stay away from that person.
Definitely. Yeah. Like persuasion is basically central to survival.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's very human. It's very universal to life in general.
And you know what else is essential to survival? A healthy gut biome.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, regardless of who you are, most life on Earth does rely on microbial, you know, symbiosis to kind of guarantee and ensure health. So definitely. Yeah,
there's no choice, right? They're in everything. I mean,
they are. Like, you know, you either coexist with them in harmony or, you know, kind of like ignore them at your own peril, essentially.
Which I think is, that's a really cool little, if you're going to narrativize this, because I remember when I learned that there are like 100 trillion cells in the human body that aren't human, you know, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
We're mostly not human.
Exactly. You're more microbe than man.
Yeah. That's insane. Nobody's got that. Again, you don't get taught that in, you know, high school biology or whatever, but it's a great story. And if it was in place, then you guys would be much easier to sell because you'd be like, yeah, all that biome, we drive you towards the healthy 97% of it. And then you can deal with the other bad 3%. So high schools need to persuade for you guys.
They should. I mean, they should say that, you know, we're not individuals. We're walking, talking ecosystems, essentially. And we're very much at like the mercy of our microbial inhabitants. I like to think that they're the ones pulling the puppet strings because, you know, they influence our mood, our digestion, and so many other things. So basically, I'm just like the giant puppet and they're the ones in charge, as far as I can tell. So
yeah, I used to describe it when I got into alternative health and started to realize how complicated all the information was about the body. Like every time you eat something, like it just has all these crazy chemical reactions throughout your entire system. So essentially, you're like in this interconnected system of chemical factories inside your body. All these organs and glands and everything else. And you have all these chemical factories and they're all interconnected and they're invisible because they're inside of you. So you can't see any of this and you're in charge. You figure out what they need. Like what? Like it's not even close to being, I don't have a chemistry degree.
Definitely.
Guys like you that are super educated about this and there's so much information, you know, as it's like, oh yeah, there's all sorts of stuff we still don't know about this.
Oh yeah. It does feel like a black box at times. And I think, you know, like the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know. But like you were talking about, like the interconnectedness of all our systems. That's one reason that I'm a little bit critical of specialization. I mean, I can see why it happened, you know, because specialization comes as a result of our focus on anatomy. But on the flip side, we also have function and, you know, structure determines function. And like function also involves, you know, energy, like how we make energy, like how we convert like the, you know, the energy in food into energy that we can use for our bodily processes. But like the thing is like, you know, our different organs, they don't exist in isolation, but that's how they're treated. Like when anything breaks down. So like, you know, you have an issue with your kidneys, you see a nephrologist, an issue with your stomach, you see a GI yeah. doctor.
They fix your kidneys and destroy your spleen. And you're like, what, yeah. what?
Right. And like, the other thing is like, you know, the division between neurology and psychology, it's completely artificial because it's one brain that is responsible for both of those things. And like the brain is very much receiving a lot of signals from the gut. And there's actually twice as much communication from the gut to the brain than in the opposite direction. But then how often does a neurologist consult with a GI doctor about migraines or seizures or anything that is affecting the brain? That never happens. And so often, at least in my personal experience, and there's also been quite a few clinical trials where they do use things like FMT for things for conditions affecting the brain, there is a lot of communication and you very much can target a lot of different neurodegenerative diseases via the gut. So I think that that's something that's, I would want to see that change, a move away from like anatomy-based specialization to medicine that looks at the systems and the, you know, the processes and that actually like acknowledges how our cells and our, you know, tissues communicate with one another because they don't exist as these separate entities. There is a lot of crosstalk between organs, between tissues, you know, between different parts of the body.
Yeah, no, I worked in weight loss for a while with persuasion, trying to figure out how to teach people to persuade people towards weight loss or do self-persuasion and weight loss in an effective way. And again, rhetoric's trying to bring all of its architecture, its whole band over here and be like, hey, you know, what instruments can we play here? They're going to work in this particular situation. And it gets very, very, again, complicated very quickly because weight is basically two systems. It's pleasure system, dopamine, tongue, you know, all these sense organs, which are just like, feed me as much pleasure as you possibly can. Incredibly clear signaling. Humans are great at it. It's not going anywhere. None of that has to do with the gut or, you know, how much weight you carry at all. They're completely two separate systems. So you're telling me to turn this one off, which is this superpower for human beings, in order to fix the other one. Well, that's a tough piece of persuasion to pull off. You know, and one of the things I wrote about in my book, the reason my book is called 21 Colosseums of Persuasion is because you essentially need to move different arenas if you're going to figure out how to persuade in your situation. And so like with health stuff, one of the chapters is ecological approaches to persuasion, because everybody does the same thing in persuasion. They're like, well, let's change the messaging. I'm like, yeah, but look at the whole ecology here of your messaging. Like we were just talking about, if you up your expertise messaging, then now you've cut down your interest, you know, attraction messaging. And if that goes down to 2%, nobody's ever going to listen to your information, you know? So what do we do here? But you have to have an ecological approach to your communication and your persuasion in the same way. Because every adjustment you make on this dial over here, it turns these bulbs down over here. And you're like, that's not going to work.
Definitely. And I think it's the same with our drugs. We're often not considering the larger ecological impacts just because like almost everything you do does have an effect on the microbiota in terms of like any sort of drug. It's not just antibiotics, pain relievers, a lot of common seizure medications, statins, those all affect the gut microbiome as well. And they also affect the mitochondria, but the effects on those systems, they're never really evaluated for like safety or anything like that. So it's just like there's, we're doing a lot of time, we're doing a lot of collateral damage without knowing it. And so many of our drugs, we don't know the exact mechanism of action. Like this is very, especially true for antidepressants. Like we think that they have these effects on like, you know, the concentrations of neurotransmitters in the brain, but nobody knows the exact mechanism of action. So that's another thing, like we're very much shooting in the dark a lot of the time. And we just don't know what's happening, like big picture on the ecological scale when we administer certain interventions or give someone a pill.
Yeah, again, it's these challenges of information, right? That the better we get at sort of figuring out all the micro, all the way down to the nano and pico of existence, then suddenly you're like, how do we keep track of all of that? And then it's also over here and you're like, there's 900 playgrounds and 5,000 kids and what do I do? So, you know, I think computers have led us down that pathway of we have more respect for our ability to handle information than probably is true, because computers can do it for us. And this is also one of the things I liked about paleo is that the evolutionary perspective basically said, yeah, most humans evolved eating things within about a mile or two of where they lived over many generations. So they figured out, and the seasons were consistent and the food was consistent. They figured out what was dangerous and what wasn't, what had these weird good effects and what didn't. And there wasn't a lot of, their body didn't have to deal with a lot of new range outside of what it adapted to. So that just in itself, you know, is a much simpler system for human beings, which is you're not supposed to control what you eat. It's supposed to be natural. It's supposed to be, I know that tastes good. I'm going to eat it. And we know this, you know, is sprouted right now. Let's eat it. There's not a lot of thinking in most, you know, real natural human eating systems. There's just sense that it's good and eat it and move on. Like cows do this with you know, there's all these different types of grass and vegetation, and they will know which ones are better, that they like better, and they'll go through the first ones and then move down fine. They'll eat the straw if they have to. But that's not intellectual. That's sensory. And exactly. I think that's how we're meant to eat, but you can't do that anymore. Like, you can't go and sniff your package at the grocery. Yeah.
We're definitely less intuitive because, you know, we can get food year round now, so we don't have to eat whatever's in season or whatever is whatever will support the climate that's local to us. I mean, there, of course, a lot of people do choose to eat locally and do choose to eat in season for health reasons. But definitely, like, with the availability and the fact that we can, you know, create artificial growing conditions to have food even out of season, definitely has, you know, changed the game for us. One thing that I find kind of interesting about the paleo community specifically is that, you know, some practitioners or like some adherents seem to claim that, you know, only one type of way of eating is, like, you know, normal or natural. When the fact is, like, if you look at hunter-gatherer groups over the ages, we've like managed to survive on a wide variety of different diets, depending on, you know, where we find ourselves geographically. There was this really great resource called the Ethnographic Atlas, and I think George Murdoch is the one who compiled it, but he was just, you know, compiling information on the dietary habits of various hunter-gatherer groups. And that included groups like the Hadza in Tanzania, who are, like, very well researched in terms of, like, their microbiome and how it changes in the wet versus dry seasons. But then also groups like the Inuit, who kind of relied very much on, you know, whale blubber, muktuk, things that, you know, a very high fat diet, a place where not very much vegetation could grow because of permafrost. But, you know, they also, you know, thrived on that diet. So it's just, it's very interesting if you look at just the history of our species, and it doesn't seem to matter so much, you know, the sources from where we get our nutrients, just the fact that we do acquire them just based off of what's available to us in a certain area.
Yeah, I think paleo is one of those communities that a third of the practitioners learn the surface of the concepts and they just drive them hard. And it's like, and then a third in the middle are kind of respect the complexity. And then a third over here really get it. So exactly what you're saying, there are a bunch of paleo people who also will be like, yeah, this is wide variety. And, you know, we have to account for that and sort of take a look at what that actually means, especially, like, you know, the difference in enzymes and things like that across, you know, light, sunlight cultures. You know, all that kind of stuff gets really super interesting, the way that we evolved. But they do, there's a good science tradition to it, but there's also a lot of bad practitioners, I think. And my thing was always, I don't really understand any of the science. Like, I can track it. I'm smart enough to track what you're saying. I don't really know any of it. You know, I don't know anything about the biome. I don't know. I know the concepts and the words when you say them, but I've never done any of that research. I don't know who's right or wrong. And as a persuader, as a, you know, and person that has to deal with information, because information is used to persuade, I'm always like, yeah, everybody's information is flawed. So don't just jam information in my face and tell me to believe it, because I'll break it, you know, right in front of you if you want me to. But it's the sense of knowing, you know, the best information that you've got that can get you to the best chances for things like health or baby health or whatever. That's why I think when I run across people like you and your company that you're working for, I'm like, yeah, these are super smart people. And they're really looking closely at a lot of this. They're the kind of people I trust to make these decisions for me, you know, because I don't know anything about baby health, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and we ourselves are learning all the time. Like, we keep a close eye on the literature. Anytime anything new comes out, we're trying to figure out, you know, how high quality is this data? Can we corroborate it? Is there a way to incorporate it in what we do? So I definitely think, like, you know, we're never going to fully arrive. We can just try to get as close as possible based off of what we know right now.
It's always fascinating to me too, that the people that are doing the work like you're doing, that are monitoring all the information and everything else, they tend to self-deprecate a little bit, where they're like, yeah, we know it's not, but you're so far farther along than everybody else who seems to have perfect confidence. And, oh no, you don't need to breastfeed, or, you know, 6 months and that's plenty. They're fully confident, they don't self-deprecate at all. But the people who are at the cutting edge of information, who know that there are flaws in their information, ended up discrediting a little bit of their credibility because, you know, they don't come across as strong. We see this a lot in politics where people make unmitigated claims about things they know nothing about. But because it's a strongly stated claim, it has more persuasive power than the people who are equivocating because they understand the nature of information. So it's interesting sometimes to try to get, and I've had this when I worked with alternative health people, I'm like, no, say it strongly. Don't mitigate it. Don't equivocate. Everybody, I'll add that in for you. You don't have to do it. Like, you're not taking your credibility in your hand as an expert by making a super strong statement. Let them do their work of deconstructing you if they want to, but don't do it for them. So it's interesting to, again, to take, like, work with information specialists and try to get them to be, take that super strong expertise, move it into a public character that has persuasion strength, you know, because they do, you get nervous about claiming too much and going past the literature. And, you know, as an expert, you're like, I don't want to, you know, like, I can't say that. And I'm like, you probably could, you know, you're 97% sure it's right.
True, true. I think it's also just the point where, you know, the more you learn about something, the more you're acutely aware of the limitations. And you feel like, you know, you just kind of want to be transparent about what we do and don't know. And at least for me, with my experiences in the healthcare profession, I sort of, you know, I was always kind of turned off by the arrogance of it. You know, so many doctors seem to have a God complex of sorts and seem to think that, you know, my word is the last word. And they seem to say, you know, insist that they know more about my physiology than I do, even though, like, I have a unique genetic composition, I have a unique microbiome composition, but still, because he holds this, like, medical degree, he knows more about me. And I think that, you know, I sort of, you know, react to that in a way of, you know, wanting to kind of approach things with a little more humility, just because there is variation, there are unknowns, because I would have appreciated that if someone had spoken to me in that way. So I guess that's a little bit of where I come from as well. I just think that science should not be afraid to admit its shortcomings in a way, because I feel like that instills more trust for me when, you know, people are also critical of their own models, because to me, it shows, like, you know, that they've done their due diligence and they're not kind of, like, you know, closing their mind off to, you know, any opposition. To me, it just makes their argument a little stronger. But that's just, like, the where I come from when I think about it.
Yeah, the problem, like, I think for a lot of people, and again, this is one of the issues with scientists and people who, you know, are really good with information, is when they move over into other situations, other locations, other organizations. Like, you saw this with Fauci, you know, who is a good scientist and was doing exactly what you said about, well, best we know right now and things like that, and just got eviscerated by politicians for doing that, because politicians don't equivocate. Mm-hmm. On the right, they don't equivocate. They make super strong statements, and if they see equivocation, they attack it. And so, like, I just watched him sometimes going, what is going on here? I'm like, it's called politics, man. You know, you are not in this game. You have not played this game. And so I think he's picked up on it a little bit, but yeah, that's not what that's not the guy you want doing your political spokesmanship. But Trump drug him into the political arena, and the right really loves to get non-experienced politicians or people into the political arena, because it can destroy them. That's why it goes after education, because they can't defend themselves. They say things like critical race theory, and it's like, that sounds horrible. I'm going to attack that for the next month. But they're not politicians, you know, they're academics or they're medical people and things like that. And if you move across situations, like, that's part of the problem with tech companies and information companies trying to do business messaging. Like, you're now into sales and marketing. And so you need, like we were talking about earlier, exciting messages, you know, thrilling messages. You can't just, I don't want your information in my commercial.
Yeah.
You know? And I have this argument a lot, not so much an argument, but trying to get people to understand, you're playing now in the marketing space, the sales space. Like, keep all your other rhetoric great, you know, keep it nice and pristine over in the medical and, you know, intellectual space, but I can't use that and get you any, you know, attention. So
that makes sense. Definitely. Yeah. And I think it is kind of like what you're going, you know, what you're alluding to is that you kind of have to know your audience. Like if you're in the political arena, you have to conduct yourself in a certain way. And I think, you know, whatever audience you're targeting, your messaging would change based off their needs and, you know, their expectations and what they respond to.
Yeah, it sounds, that's exactly right. And that sounds intuitive and easy. Turns out it's really hard to move across these institutions. And that's, again, why I see people, really good people and well-meaning people in politics just get destroyed. And I'm like, let me show you how to destroy back, you know, yeah. Because I hate watching, really, it's just unethical politics, stained politics. It's really easy to play. You just attack somebody for something they've said wrong or some tiny piece of their bio or whatever. And you just stop, you never stop saying it. And the right has played that unethical political game to the point now where everybody's, it's just dominated everything and it ruins public discourse in politics because you can no longer get information from the people who want to give you information because they're getting stained by the politicians. And so, but that's what they do. And so you have to sort of set up for it. So I would never send somebody into a political arena and be like, look, they're going to do this to you. And here are the strategies you need to practice, but you're going to fail because you haven't done this for 10 years the way that they have. But here's a couple of things, like just never respond to it. Like don't, they ask you a question, don't respond to that question. Just say whatever you want. And you give people tactics like that and you watch the right sort of fall apart because they're like, why aren't they playing my game? Like, yeah, rhetorician gave them some advice.
Yeah, I can imagine like from one arena to another and it's like the rules of the game have completely changed. Like nothing makes sense anymore. And like people aren't responding to logic and reason in this arena. And why is that?
Yeah, no. And even this, like doing a podcast, it's part entertainment. Needs to be a kinetic conversation so people can, you know, enjoy the pace of it and the speed and the energy and the things they're getting out of it. But it also needs good information, right? That people are like, oh, I could probably use that idea or I never thought of that because then you get those little intellectual explosions that people like so much. And so it's really an information game and an entertainment game. And you have to be doing both if you're, that's kind of what I try to do is like, I like both those worlds. And so like, if I can bring them together, you know, in these kind of conversations, that's what I, at least what I'm after. So
your own special brand of edutainment.
Yeah, there you go. Edutainment. All right. So we were quitting 30 minutes ago, but now we're going to quit.
Okay. Sounds good.
Super fun. Thanks so much. Do you want to pitch your company a little bit for people that want to go find it or?
Sure. So we're Tiny Health and we are going to be launching our closed beta in January and we're focusing on gut microbiome and vaginal health during the first 1000 days of life to ensure like the best possible start to your child's future.
Are you looking for customers or investors?
Customers at the moment. We're just kind of trying to validate the technology and kind of, you know, get people in the door, get results and kind of get comfortable with our processes and get feedback as well.
I'm going to hook you up with my friend, Kirsten. She has a fertility business and kind of online tech business that she's been doing like this for a while. And you guys will really enjoy talking to each other. So she's been on the podcast too.
Exciting.
All right, cool.
Thank me.
Yeah, thanks. Super fun. Appreciate it very much. That is Nita Jain with Tiny Health. Everybody go check it out and come back again while you wait to come back again, go out and persuade some people. They need it.